guy. So it is Father's Day, and unfortunately, Elizabeth and I and the kids, we couldn't be at worship at 10 a.m. this morning due to some other things going on. We were prevented from being there this morning. So we are. I had planned this for our worship as well as for this afternoon, but that's all right. So we'll just do this afternoon for the lesson. So on Mother's Day, I guess it was this year, maybe it was last year, I discussed four spiritual lessons I learned from my mother. And obviously Mother's Day, excuse me, and Father's Day are days that our society set aside to honor these individuals who either are our mothers or fathers or served in some capacity in those roles that helped us in the roles that mothers and fathers do. And so obviously there are physical lessons that we gain from the traditional roles of mothers and fathers, whether it's learning how to golf or tie a tie or how to fish or throw a football or, you know, hammer stuff, that sort of thing. Fathers certainly play a role in that, in the upbringing both of their sons and their daughters, of a physical type. But certainly there are physical lessons that fathers are uniquely designed as well as obligated, according to the scriptures, to provide for their kids. And so there are four spiritual lessons that I want to share that I learned from my father. These are lessons that I value highly, just as lessons that I've learned from my mother as well. So first thing we want to discuss is that it's okay if things don't turn out the way you expect. That's one thing that growing up that I observed from my dad. You know, a lot of times things didn't happen the way you want them to or the way you planned for them to. And there were some major events. We had a brief move to Atlanta, Georgia we were there, I guess, for maybe 6 months or so, thereabouts, maybe a little bit longer. And then we ended up moving right back to where we were in Columbia, in Hopkins, South Carolina. That's just kind of one of those things that just happened. And you don't know why things like that happen the way they do. But the key component is to be content, even when things don't turn out the way you expect or want for them to turn out. And obviously, being content has a much broader application, especially in today's society. There's so much lack of contentedness. And the term contented means to be sufficient for today. Okay, God has made me sufficient for today. There may be things I have on my wish list. There may be things that I have on my Amazon want list that I'm waiting to go on sale or whatever. There may be things that I even think that I may need, but God has made me sufficient today. And because of that, I can thank God for what I have, and I'm not going to allow the things I don't have to cause me to be miserable. And that's a key component here. And this is why Paul says, this is in context of the Philippians, he's writing to them regarding the fact that for a while the Philippians weren't able to support Paul physically, either with money or clothes or food or whatever. But then they were able to once again. He says, I rejoice in the Lord greatly that now at last your care for me has flourished again. Though you surely did care, but you lacked opportunity. It's not that they didn't care, it's just they weren't able to. But then Paul says in verse 11, not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. So when Paul makes a statement, understand that Paul's describing times where he has gone without. But that didn't change anything. He learned how to be content, even in those situations where maybe he was hungry, where he did suffer need, when he was abased. That's why Paul says what he says in verse 11. Not that I speak in regard to need. It's not that I have to have the things I need in order for me to be happy, or for that matter, to be content. And there is a difference between happiness and contentedness. Happiness is an emotion. And being happy, you may have everything you want. In fact, as is often the case, you may have everything you want and be unhappy. And people who may not have everything they want may also be unhappy. But then there may be times where you're happy and there may not be a reason, or there may be a reason, but it comes and it goes. Whereas being joyous, and we've talked about this before, is recognizing that I'm blessed of God. Okay, I'm blessed by God, and God has given me the things that He deems me needing, and He has blessed me in ways perhaps even beyond need, as is the case often in our, at least in our country. We have even things beyond what we need. We have luxuries that maybe many people don't have access to. But the idea of being content carries with it the sense of immediate blessing, that God has blessed me today. God has given me what I need for today. I am sufficient today. And so that being the case, that's why it's so important to understand that when Paul says, "I have learned whatever state I am to be content," that, it may not be a happy thing to be starving, to literally be hungry and starving. But Paul said, "I can be content," because even in that state of being hungry and starving, God has given me what I need for today. And it's not taken into account tomorrow. This is just for today. And God is with me today. He has blessed me today. And that's all that it considers. And that contentedness doesn't focus on the things that one doesn't have. It focuses on what God has given me for the day. Similar statement in Hebrews. And we won't go to all the scriptures that I have listed on these slides. But for a bunch of these, I do want to mention them. Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have, for he himself has said, "I will never leave you nor forsake you." And of course, this speaks as much to how we treat and look at other people and what they have as it does what I may have or may lack. Let your conduct be without covetousness. You don't look at other people, first of all, and wish ill will on others because you wish they didn't have something and you did. But even more than that, notice he says, let your conduct be without covetousness. Covetousness has a way of causing or changing the way we treat other people. If they have something that I wish I had, and I allow that to be an obsession, I allow that to be something, it's not just, oh man, I wish I had that Ferrari or whatever, but it becomes a, if I see that person every day at work or every day at school, and I treat them badly, and I maybe I conspire to cause bad things to happen to them, or in some way for them to get in trouble because I don't like them because they have things I want. That carries with it the idea of covetousness as well, especially if it's in an effort to gain that possession from that person. That goes even further. Be content with such things as you have. Does this mean that everyone's going to be blessed exactly the same? No, not everyone's going to be blessed exactly the same. And that's what Paul's point is. You be content with such things as God has given you. Now, does this mean that sometimes people may not share with you? Well, sure, people, especially brethren, are to share with one another, especially when it comes to physical needs, where to take care of each other. But this is one characteristic that I learned from my dad. Second one is to trust that there's a reason why things happen or don't happen. Throughout the Bible, we have example of providence. And providence is one of those things. We talk about God's providence. It's not, when we compare providence and miracle, a miracle is an observable suspension of natural law. Okay, in the middle of a storm, Jesus says, "Peace be still," and all of a sudden it's, "Peace be still," and all of a sudden it stops. Okay, that's not normal. All right, for a man born blind, all of a sudden to have his sight restored to him, that's not normal. For someone who was lame or crippled, for their legs to be restored, and think it's not just them getting up and walking, but there had to be some sort of a visual, their feebleness in their legs, all of a sudden the strength, they could see the muscles come back. withered limbs and so forth come back to full strength. That's not normal. Those are visible, observable suspensions of natural law. Whereas providence is much harder to put your finger on. You can see God's working, God's power there, in there somewhere, in the order that things happen, in the way things happen, or maybe should have happened but didn't. And you go, how did God do that? How did that work out just right for this to happen this way or not to happen that way? And you can't put your finger on any one spot because it's not necessarily an observable miracle. Okay, and that's what a miracle is an observable suspension of natural law. Doesn't mean that God's power is not being applied in there. It's just that we're not able to observe where God's power is being applied. And this is why in the Bible, often God's providence is often labeled kind of in that way, where it's, you can't quite put your finger on it. For instance, Philemon verse 10, where Paul writes to Philemon about Onesimus, and he says, perhaps this is why he left for a time. Well, Onesimus ran away. Okay, he was a slave of Philemon, and he ran away. He wasn't a Christian at the time, but he happens to stumble into Rome somewhere along the way, I guess finds brethren, and ends up meeting Paul. Paul baptizes him. And in that process, now Paul's sending Onesimus back to Philemon. But Paul says, perhaps this is why, and it's always that phrase, perhaps maybe this is why this happened this way. So that now you could receive him back, not only as a slave, but now also as a brother. Esther chapter 4 and verse 14 is a famous one as well. It's the statement from Mordecai that he ends up giving to... Where's Esther? There it is. Esther, Job. Yeah, there we go. Chapter 4. Mordecai, it's through a messenger, but he gives a message to Esther to remind her of what she needs to do for her people as they're facing destruction. And in verse 13, Mordecai told them to answer Esther, "Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" It's always in perhaps this is why. Maybe this is, all designed for this reason. Maybe this is how this happened for this, so that this would happen at this point in time. It's one of those things that it's hard to put your finger on where God's working in all of this. And yet, all through Esther, even though God's not mentioned specifically, God's all through there. He is all through Esther. I mean, if you read the book of Esther, Esther's a great commentary, or great... the amount of providence involved in the entire book of Esther, just going from start to finish, is just unreal. I mean, at one point, the king couldn't sleep, and so he had the records read to him, and it just happened to be the record where Mordecai had warned about an assassination plot, and the king asked, "Did we ever reward Mordecai?" "No, we never did anything for Mordecai," and that ends up being a big deal. Why couldn't the king sleep? Did God make it where the king couldn't sleep for some reason? What was it God did exactly? Did God make it where the king had a long day and he couldn't sleep? Did he make it where he drank coffee before bed and couldn't sleep? What did God do? And it's one of those things, that's how providence works. You can't put your finger on it. You don't know exactly where God's power is working, but you know it is, because things don't just happen by coincidence like that. Okay, especially in a pattern in this way. Coincidence, one thing. Some people may consider it luck. But when you have a pattern of coincidence and luck, it's not just coincidence and luck. Okay, there's reasons why things happen like that, the way that they do. And that's part of what Paul addresses in Philemon verse 10. In Ephesians chapter 1 and 1 Timothy chapter 4, all of these speak to what our roles are, especially given what God has done for us and allowed for us to do. So like in Ephesians 1 and verse 11, he talks about the fact that we have obtained an inheritance being predestined according to the purpose of him who works all things according to the counsel of his will, that we who first trusted in Christ should be to the praise of his glory. In him you also trusted after you heard the word of truth, the gospel of your salvation. He describes all of this. This is what God did. And he talks about being predestined here. And of course, this predestination isn't that God specifically chose individuals to be saved, but he had already designed the plan of salvation. He had already planned how he was going to bring about the salvation of his creation. And in doing so, he had already planned on what the character is going to be for those individuals to be saved. Okay, what type of template must they meet in order for them to have forgiveness of sins and go to heaven? They must meet the template of Jesus Christ. God planned all of these things beforehand, and it speaks to God's ability and power to know what's going to happen, how people are going to react. But God planned all of that to happen a certain way. Did he make the Jews reject Jesus? No, he didn't. But he knew that's how they would react. Okay, he understood that this is how they're going to react, and this is what the prophecy spoke to. There's a reason why things happen or don't happen, that sometimes you have to, and sometimes, you know what, and this kind of speaks to providence also, we can speculate as to the lessons, perhaps, that we are to learn from certain things that happen or don't happen. And we can gain application from any number of ways in which something that happens or doesn't happen affect us. But you know what? In the end, some things may happen or don't happen for a much broader, much more important purpose than simply for us. All we have access to is our little slice of perception. Yet God sees the big picture. And so what may happen or not happen to us may not have anything to do with us. Maybe the entire reason something happens to us is for an example to another brother or sister. And we have no idea that they're going through something, but they see us go through it and it gives them strength. Okay, and we'll never know. We'll never know. And this is the beauty of providence, is that maybe this is why. Maybe this is why this happened, so that I would be here at this time to help that person. You know, you just don't know why. And that's the beauty, but also, you know, for those of us who are obsessed with knowing the mysteries of why things happen and don't happen and what the reasons for them were, we have to understand. And Job, this is a great lesson that Job learned as well. I don't have it on here, but, you know, all the things that happened to Job had a purpose. But Job had to learn that he didn't have to know why. He didn't have to know what the purpose was. And that's what that's kind of what the ultimate message of the book of Job is. Job chapter 42, I have asked those things that I have no right to know. And he repented in sackcloth and ashes. And the reason for it was that he questioned God's wisdom. God never told him, hey, the devil challenged you. And I wanted to prove that you would be faithful. Never says that God explained that. But Job had to be okay with not knowing why it happened, only that it did happen according to God's will, and that he was still required to be faithful. And that's a great lesson to learn. Thirdly, and very quickly, the beauty of analogy. So my dad, he enjoys taking phrases from movies and using them in sermons. And I've been known to do that from time to time myself. This is something that Jesus preached in parables. Okay, Jesus preached in using everyday situations, everyday things that could very well have happened. And that's what a parable is, an example of a real-life possible scenario that is designed to bring out a spiritual application, okay, or a spiritual moral of the story, so to speak. Jesus, on regular occasions, taught in parables. But it's important to note that there were times where Jesus was asked, Jesus, why are you speaking in parables? What is the purpose for you teaching this the way that you are? So, for instance, in Matthew chapter 13 and verse 34, all these things Jesus spoke to the multitude in parables, and without a parable, he did not speak to them. Okay, so you go back through and he talks about the kingdom of heaven and the value of the kingdom of heaven and what things that are going to parable the sower and so forth, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the prophet, saying, I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter things kept secret from the foundation of the world. Jesus taught in parables to give people, and to really, in a lot of ways, teach people the value of understanding you can take everyday type of situations and apply it to a spiritual purpose or spiritual lesson or application, and to help people make kind of bridge that difference and to train them to think in spiritual ways. When Jesus spoke to the Samaritan woman at the well and he talked about the water that he could give her, which she would never thirst again, she thought he was talking about literal water. And yet, he wasn't. And that he was talking about spiritual water. But see, some of them didn't understand how parables worked, how analogies worked. This is why in Matthew chapter 13, verse 10, the disciples came and said to him, why do you speak to them in parables? Why not just come out and say what you're going to say? Jesus says, because it has been given to you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been given. It's not that Jesus was hiding things or didn't want people to know the truth. He needed to teach them first how to think in spiritual ways. That's what they had to learn. They had to learn how to be able to think in a spiritual format, especially given the fact that there were factions of the Jews, like the Sadducees, who didn't even believe in a spiritual realm. They didn't believe in angels. They believed God was flesh and blood. Okay, they didn't believe in the spirit. So how can you explain to somebody spiritual things when they have been raised up and taught that there is no such thing as a spirit or spiritual realm? You're going to have to lead them to that point. And that's why Jesus did that. But there's a phrase that my dad used once. I'll never forget it. And I don't remember what the broader point of the sermon was. It had something to do with temptation or an application about temptation. But this is a statement that my dad made in one of his lessons that he preached when I was growing up. He said, just as Wile E. Coyote is ever after the Roadrunner, so the devil is ever after you. And he used this in association with what Peter says in First Peter chapter 5 about the devil being like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. But there was a broader point or application within the lesson itself about Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner, and there was associations with the devil trying all these schemes, trying to catch you and try to trap you and so forth. I remember that much. But this was his conclusion. And it just stuck with me. And that's one of those things, it made sense, because I grew up, you know, watching Looney Tunes and Wile E. Coyote try to do all these things to catch the Roadrunner. And yet the Roadrunner was always one step ahead. Okay, the Roadrunner was always aware of himself, and he was always aware of what was happening, and he never let the coyote ever catch him. And that, to me, to kind of picture the devil in that way of scheming and plotting, and of course, obviously, the devil's not as harmless as Wile E. Coyote was, but to understand that relationship, that analogy, it helped me when I was young. And that's something that, this is why Jesus taught the way that he did, because it helps people to understand spiritual lessons that are important for them to understand. And then finally, last point for you this afternoon, to whom much is given, much shall be required. And this actually kind of comes after Jesus describes this whole aspect. Some of this is what Jesus describes as well. In verse 12, whoever has, to him more will be given, and he will have abundance. Whoever does not have, even what he has will be taken away from him. Therefore I speak to them in parables, because seeing they do not see, hearing they do not hear, nor do they understand. And of course, Jesus quotes the prophecy from Isaiah, "Hearing you will hear and shall not understand, seeing you will see, not perceive. The hearts of this people have grown dull." So they're not used to thinking in this way and understanding in the ways that they need to. And that's part of what to whoever has more will be given. An understanding, an ability to think in the way of the Spirit. If you have that ability, you'll gain even more. Okay, especially from the teachings of parables, for instance. Well, as it relates to what Jesus says in Luke chapter 12 and in verse 58, this, to me, is a very important point, especially when it comes to discussing the type of abilities that we have and the opportunities that we're given. Again, this is in the context of a parable. Peter said to him, "Lord, do you speak this parable only to us or to all people?" And of course, he talks about the thief and the servants who are waiting. And then in verse 42, the Lord said, "Who then is that faithful and wise steward whom his master will make ruler over his household to give them their portion of food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master will find so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will make him ruler over all that he has. But if that servant says in his heart, 'My master's delaying his coming,' and begins to beat the male and female servants to eat and drink and be drunk, the master of that servant will come on a day when he's not looking for him, and at an hour when he's not aware, and will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the unbelievers. That servant who knew his father's will and did not prepare himself or do according to his will shall be beaten with many stripes. He who did not know yet committed these things deserving of stripes shall be beaten with few. For everyone to whom much is given, to him much will be required. And to whom much has been committed, of him they will ask the more." So as Jesus speaks about this and he's answering Peter, It's answer to Peter. "Lord, do you speak this parable only to us or to all people?" And this is the point. See, is those of you who have the ability to understand, much is expected. Okay, those for whom they don't have the ability, yet they still commit the wrong. Okay, they will still much. There is some expected of them as well. But to whom much has, that's what his point is about, deserving of stripes, they shall be beaten with a few. Some people read this as being there's going to be a hotter hell for some and a lesser hell for others. That's not what Jesus is saying. That's not his point. He's using analogy once again. Those servants who aren't aware of the master's commandments, those who committed those things deserving of stripes, but they didn't know any better, they're going to be more forbearance and more patience with them than there will be. And here's what the real point is. People focus on that part. The point is those people who know better and yet they do it anyway, they will be beaten with many stripes. And that's really what Jesus' emphasis is. For everyone to whom much is given, whether that's understanding, okay, and that's kind of the point here is that the parables are meant to provide understanding, especially for people who are able to understand the spiritual points. And that's what his point is that while the rest of the people may not get this, Peter, you and these other apostles specifically, but the rest of the disciples should get it. Okay, because to you, understanding has been given. You understand, or should at least understand, what these things mean. And so I expect more from you than perhaps some of these others who were raised not understanding what the Spirit means. For everyone to whom much is given, from him much will be required. To whom much has been committed, of him they will ask the more. The understanding of this is, and this is kind of the application of what Jesus is saying, when a person has the knowledge, the understanding of what Jesus says, and then you couple that with the blessings that God has given us, the abilities that God gives to each person, much is expected. Okay, we can't just take what we have and sit on it and then do nothing with it. We actually have to utilize the blessings that God has given us to continue to spread the gospel, to help others come to a knowledge of the truth, whether that's teaching, preaching, seizing opportunities to help other people, counseling, whether it's counseling brethren or counseling people who perhaps they consider us to have some wisdom and they ask us our thoughts on things, to be able to include spiritual applications in the things that we tell them, being a servant to others. These are all ways in which we have been given much, but we have to understand that we will be held responsible if we have been given all of these blessings and all these opportunities and all of these abilities, and we don't use them to the extent that God requires or wants us to do. And that's something else that my dad taught me as well. And that's, when I think about, especially growing up and watching all the things, my dad actually was kind of he was a quote-unquote part-time preacher. He preached full-time, but he also worked a full-time job. And there were a lot of things that I remember my dad spending time to do, studying, especially on Saturdays when he was off of work. He'd sit in his chair and study for Bible class or study for a sermon. He's still very quick to try to help other people, very conscientious about brethren and so forth. And that's one thing that I carry with me, that I value greatly. So these are four things that hopefully can help us not only to be better servants of God ourselves, to take these lessons and apply them ourselves in our lives, but also for those of us who are fathers or serve in a role to help children or young people, to maybe help emphasize some of these aspects to them as well. Because these are important. These are broad life lessons, spiritual life lessons that children need to understand and young people need to understand. And if we have the ability to reach them, we need to try to do the best we can to do so. All right.